Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to a very special Empire podcast. Edgar Wright's latest film, Last Night in Soho, is now out on DVD, Blu-ray, 4K, digital, all the good stuff for you to enjoy in the comfort of your own home, whether you live in Soho or not. It's an absolute belter of a film, this psychological horror with lots to talk about. So much so, in fact, that when Edgar Wright and his co-writer Christy Wilson-Cairns came into the Pod booth in December of last year, towards the end of the movie's theatrical run, we spoke for 2.5 hours about the movie. And, if I'm honest, Peter Jackson's Get Back as well. A lot of Get Back chat, in fact. The interview is available in full for Spoiler Special subscribers, but because it was so overflowing with goodness, we've decided to share some of it with you here on the regular feed. So, as our gift to you, here is about an hour of freewheeling, free-flowing, spoiler-filled chat with Edgar Wright and Christy Wilson-Cairns. As ever, do only listen to this if you have seen Last Night in Soho, or else none of this is going to make a lick of sense. Do please enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on this Last Night in Soho spoiler special by Edgar Wright and Christy Wilson-Cairns. How are you both?
Hello, hello. Nice to see you.
I'm well, thank you. I'm ready to spoil some stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Finally, we can take the sellotape off our mouths and talk about this. Because I've interviewed you both at length about this movie over the last, 2.5 years or something like that. But there's things that I haven't asked you and I've been dying to ask you, so I'm going to ask you now. But I must say, Edgar, you were kind enough to arrange for access to the commentary track that you guys recorded. And towards the end of the commentary track, you talk about that you're, because you recorded just before the film's going to come out.
Yeah.
So, Christy, you say that November 1st is going to come around after the film opens. And at that point, you're going to feel bereft.
Yes.
We're now recording this on December 3rd. How are you feeling?
Bereft. True to form. Absolutely bereft.
No, it is definitely a thing where you kind of feel like you've been living with the movie and in the movie. I mean, to sort of really like sort of just make it extra complicated, both me and Christy both have offices in Soho and I live very close to one of the locations in the movie. So I
you
think
live
maybe
in Gooch Place.
A tactical area. I don't actually live on Gooch Place. But I can see Eloise's like window like from my flat. So which is, I realize it might be a tactical error. It would be like fucking William Friedkin like living next to the Georgetown steps. It's like, why would you do that to yourself? So, I mean, there's that. But also, I mean, I think it's so sort of personal for us in so many weird ways, this movie, that there's this thing where, you know, just like, I don't know, it's really strange. I mean, I found myself like right at the end of the kind of press tour rereading the research that was done for the movie, mm-hmm. that was done, I think, in like 2012. And as soon as I started reading it, it kind of started me firing off in like 100 other directions. And I was thinking, I'm probably never going to make a movie like this ever again, but I feel sad that like it's over. Yeah, for sure.
Well, in terms of, there's maybe another direction to go or another story to tell? Or?
I don't know. I think I just enjoyed making this movie so much that I sort of feel sad to say goodbye.
Yeah.
I mean, you see that with like Tarantino. Every press tour that he does, he immediately starts talking about like either a direct sequel, like another a stage version. Yeah. I mean, he literally did it Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. He loved it so much that he spent the next year writing a novelization.
Yeah.
And writing, sort of rewriting the script in a different form. It's sort of fascinating. And that's, I think, is a sort of, it's difficult to, it's that thing is that if like you gave birth and then the child was immediately adopted and you never saw it again, it's like, ah, no. Like,
but you have to walk past the child every day.
Yes.
That's the thing, because it must be a strange experience for you guys, you know, because the movie is so wedded to Soho and it's so much about, you know, the ghosts of Soho. And you both work, and Edgar lives at 10 Gooch Place. I'm going to keep guessing until we get there.
I'd like to apologize to the owners of 8 Gooch Place that we never changed the address. I realized that was maybe a bad thing to do. And whether they have, you know, like sort of people I know that they have people taking photos outside.
Oh, shit.
Because I've seen them on the internet, so I just like to apologise.
Do you walk by every now and again just to do a little drive-by photo op with people who are taking pics?
Well, you know, I did take my girlfriend's family around the other day. They said they wanted to see some of the locations, and I was showing them around the locations of Soho, and somebody walked past, and then later on Twitter said, hey, I'm sure I saw Edgar Wright giving a locations tour for Soho. How do I get in on that tour? He goes, how do I get in on that tour? And I said, be my family? Like, sort of like, question mark.
Okay, yes, and how do I do that? How do I get involved in that?
Do you know a
business?
Funny story? And I think I can say this because I know that they've moved, but you know that, like, Bo Burnham and Loreen Scafaria,
yes,
like, who are a couple, they lived, and I think even you've seen his special Inside, mm-hmm, right? Amazing. Mm-hmm. They lived in the house from Nightmare on Elm Street. And when they bought the house, they didn't realize it was a location. And then they noticed people taking photos outside the house, especially around Halloween. And then they realized it was the house from Nightmare on Elm Street, and the estate agent had never told them.
That's wild.
The one at the end of the first movie where Ronnie Blakely gets pulled through the glass.
Yes,
that house.
Ronnie Blakely gets pulled through the door.
You know Ronnie Blakely, Oscar nominee for Nashville. Come on. It's that deep a cut.
Not a dummy that looks nothing like Ronnie
Blakely. Okay, I see where you're going. Yes, a dummy that looks like Oscar nominee Ronnie Blakely.
And has none of the attributes of a human being in any way, shape, or form otherwise. But it must be weird, because then you're walking around Soho every day and you're going, oh, well, we shot that over there, yeah, and we did that over there. And it must be every day you're flooded with memories of this movie, which is the movie a microcosm in a way.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard now to drink at the Toucan without thinking about, first of all, shooting the movie and also what the movie is about. And I'm just sitting in there like, I hope I don't see a weird guy in a suit.
But again, that must be the same thing then, because you are still drinking at the Toucan then.
Of course.
Okay, so and now
still
people...
still drinking, I'll still be at the Toucan.
Do you still pull pints at the Toucan now and again?
No,
just leap
only,
over the bar like Starsky?
Only if I get out of line will I do that. I try very hard, even in the run-up to Christmas, I try very hard to be, you know, okay, restrained.
Yeah, it's important. We're December 3rd, we've got a long way to go.
We're very proud of our permanent contribution to the Toucan. I don't know if you know about this.
Yes.
Let me give the context of the story. So... we're shooting Terrence's scene, like, outside the Toucan, kind of like his final scene in the movie. And I think Terrence, God bless him, I think, you know, it's tough doing night shoots and stuff. And so I know why he said what he said. Is partly he's trying to think, how can we finish earlier? Because it's like fucking 3 a.m, like, on a night shoot. But he sees me setting up a shot of the Toucan pub, the real Toucan pub where Chris used to work, has these stairs that come up from the basement on the outside. And in the scene where Eloise kind of confronts Terrence Stamp's character, who in the script is called Silver-Haired Gentleman,
yeah,
but as we know, spoiler special, his real name is Lindsay. He's walking up those steps to go out on the street, you know, and she's chasing him. And Terrence sees me setting up like a high angle of these steps. And he said, you're not going to shoot these steps, are you? And I looked at Terrence and said, what do you mean? He goes, these steps are not good enough to be in a movie. I think maybe his ulterior motive was like, can we do one less shot and I go home? Like, maybe that's what he was really getting at. But I laughed so hard because I was thinking, I said, Terrence, I promise you these steps will be in the movie. But I love the idea that he thought they weren't good enough to be in the film.
Work with much better steps than this.
To be fair, steps are pretty bad.
The steps are pretty bad. Terrence is not wrong. Maybe they don't believe on the... But I was thinking, that's exactly why they have to be in a film. It's because nobody in their right mind would shoot these steps. Maybe you're right. Maybe the other thing that's going on is that Terrence had a better set of steps around the corner and wanted to get like a location finder's fee.
He got free pints from the Nelly Dean to use their steps.
But perhaps...
here's the payoff to this. Okay, so the owners of the Toucan had a plaque made and put it on the top step of those steps, a gold plaque that says, these stairs are not good enough to be in a movie, Terrence Stamp, July 2019. And so now, forever at the Toucan is what we like to call the Terrence Stamp step.
Yes.
That's amazing.
And I went to see it the other day. I was out, name drop alert. I was out to dinner with Ryan Johnson. I actually ran into Christy on the street as we came out of a restaurant and she was watching the Jaws play, the shark.
Oh, how was it?
Good.
Yeah, okay, good. We'll
the
do a spoiler special for that.
The shark is not working. What's it called?
The shark is broken.
The shark is broken. Okay. With Ian Shaw, Robert Shaw's
son. The one
son.
Thing I will say about it is it was a very rowdy audience in the night I was in, and right. there was a woman two seats down from me so drunk, and they went cheers on stage, and she went cheers with them, and then she gave a complete commentary. And there's a bit where he talks about a sad song, she went, oh, he's brought down the tone, oh, he's made it depressing. So it was like quite hard to enjoy it with this this commentary.
Oh my god. And this wasn't Edgar and Ryan.
This wasn't Edgar and Ryan, just randomly.
But the reason we went on the way back to, I walked him back to his hotel and said, let's go and see the Terrence Stamp Step. So it was the first time I had seen it in person, like this plaque.
So where is it?
It's at the top. This is the great thing, you can only see it if you do the same walk that Terrence does. Yeah. So you have to be kind of inside walking up.
And it's on
the top step. If you walked up, you would see it. You can't see it from the street, but you can see it if you do the same path that he does in the movie.
That's amazing. And when he saw the movie, he must have been doubly annoyed then, because the movie is filled with other great steps that are much better than the ones in the Toucan. You know, you got the stairs in the Café de Paris, and you got the stairs at the end as well. They throw the other ones into shade.
I hadn't thought, maybe it's a, you know, like, is there kind of like
a jealousy thing?
Stairs porn? Like, sort of like, maybe there must be a thing. I mean, there must be some people that have a kink for stairs.
Of course. I think it's all women who search property. Like, oh my God, a different level. Oh.
Oh, a banister, eh? Oh, oh, very nice. Yeah, yeah, very good.
Spiral? Sweet Jesus.
I bet there's a name for that.
There probably is. I'll look it up whilst you guys are giving me an answer to another question, which is the Toucan itself. So at some point, and I don't know whether this was something that came up early in the writing process, but you have this really lovely fidelity towards London geography in this movie, which, you know, as anyone who saw Fast and Furious 6 will know, not every movie has that. So
I want to just say as an aside, and I'm not even going to mention the critic because I can't remember, but somebody said, and their major demerit of the film was that the geography was all over the place, and I want to cry bunkum. Because I said, there's one bit in the movie where there is a jump, and it's sort of in a semi-dream sequence, so I think you can get away with that. Other than that, I think the geography is dead on.
Which bit's that?
It's actually in the bit where Thomasin is chasing Anya through, like, sort of at the end when it's like the two white Macs, where Anya is kind of like in that dream way where she's always ahead and you can never catch up to her. And then, like, Thomasin runs all the way from SOAS, the library in part of UCL, and runs past Senate House and all the way down in the correct way, down, like, Store Street, down Windmill Street, across Charlotte Street, down, like, Percy Passage, across to Newman's Passage. Mm-hmm. And then there's a little jump where they go to Bateman Buildings in Soho. That is the only bit
took me
in
out
the movie.
I was furious.
But I was like, so when somebody said that the geography was completely wrong all of the time, I was saying, no, I say no. It's actually correct most of the time.
Oh my God.
I'm glad that you thought that, because I thought that too. And we, I also, it's genuinely brings me out and hives that stuff. In Baby Driver, like the opening chase, like the path that the car takes is exactly the path that you would take. And I was very happy that people in Atlanta sort of took note of that and saying, oh, the fidelity to the geography is sort of astonishing. Because, you know, did you mention Fast and Furious 6?
I did.
Like it's in London and then suddenly it goes to Manchester and Glasgow and then back again. But that's the funny thing is like, I could have told you can't do a car chase in London, guys. It's like, sort of like, it's like, it's impossible.
But people walking around is totally fine. But at the same time, to get that fidelity, was it tough to get the permits and shut places down?
I think number one, like, I just want to make my favorite one in one of my favorite films, American Wealth in London, which is, of course, one of my favorite films, probably a desert island film for me. There is that great bit where Jenny Agutter and David Norton get into a black cab driven by Alan Ford from Snatch. And in one shot, it jumps to Trafalgar Square. Like, sort of, it goes from Earl's Court to Trafalgar Square. You know, the bit where he's going, puts me in the mind of Jack the Ripper times.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like the cab goes in one shot from Earl's Court to Trafalgar Square. And I was like, wow, that's a fast cab. I mean, he's going in the right direction. He's going west.
Yeah.
No, sorry, he's going east.
Yeah.
He's going from west to east.
You would go east, yeah.
Like, it's like, to answer your question, the first thing that we did when making the movie, probably the first meetings about production when me and Marcus Rowland, the production designer, meeting Camilla Stevenson, the location manager, because in the script we had laid out pretty much where things were. And then also on top of that, we went round Soho and we like picked out these are the streets that need to be in the movie, because without these streets, it's kind of like, how can you do a Soho film without doing one bit in Old Compton Street?
Mm. Yeah.
Like, how can you do like a Soho movie without doing Dean Street, Frith Street and Greek Street?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we sort of waters. I mean, basically, we sort of just wanted to cover our bases and make sure that like the locations that you would expect to see in a Soho movie are in the movie.
Did you cover off the whole going for dinner with Billy Piper acronym?
What?
Have you heard that?
Oh, we've got a different acronym.
We have a different acronym.
Okay. Okay. Going for dinner with Billy Piper is Greek Street, Frith Street, Dean Street, Water Street, Poland Street.
Okay, I don't have the Poland Street one, but cab drivers, and this is a very un-PC term, so I'm not saying I support this acronym at all, but given that, like, sort of Soho, the sex trade still exists there, but obviously the sex trade was much more prevalent in you know, sort of past decades,
mm-hmm.
but cab drivers would do Greek, Frith, Dean, Wardour, good for dodgy women.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow. I'm sure we get a P in there somewhere. We can make that work. Yeah. I prefer the Billy Piper one.
I know what it is, but I'm not going to say it.
You can do it on the stairs. Anyway.
I'll just say water sports, but I won't say anything
yeah,
more.
Precisely. Works well on staircases.
What is the Billy Piper one again?
Going for dinner with Billy Piper.
Who the hell came up with that?
Chris Evans. Surely Chris Evans.
Going for dinner with Billy Piper. I love that.
Going for dinner with... Now, the weird thing about that is my brain would go west to east.
Yes.
Yes.
Like, I remember it the other way around. Forget Wardour Street, forget Poland Street. I remember it alphabetically.
Yeah.
Dean Frith Greek, DFG. Yeah. It's going in alphabetical order, sort of.
Yeah,
because it is that thing. It's like it is one of those things. It's a similar thing in LA. There's always this thing where like you have to remember, and this is only for LA people. It's like what order Santa Monica, Melrose, and Beverly are in. It's in that order. But it's like, but it's also when you get lost, you're like thinking, wait, which one's first, Melrose or Beverly? Like, so right. Those three like sort of streets which are really long. What order do they go in from like north to south?
Santa Monica, Melrose. Okay, got
from
it.
North I to south, it. Santa Monica. Melrose Beverly.
All right. But that doesn't have an acronym, does it? It doesn't have a...
They might do.
Okay.
It doesn't involve Billy Piper, I'm sure. Not in the States. Right.
If anyone listening to this knows the acronym, then do send in...
Who came up with the Billy Piper one?
And if you are the person who came up with going for dinner with Billy Piper, then you win dinner with Billy Piper. So I think we can probably arrange that, I'm sure. So my question back in the dim and distant past, if I can vaguely remember it, was about the locations and about the decision to use real places like a Gooch Place, which is just three doors down from where Edgar lives at 11 Gooch Place. And
you said 10 earlier.
I'm guessing. I'm moving it along. And then the Toucan, of course, as well. Now, was it the Toucan you're doing, Christy, or was it always...
Yeah. Well, I mean, when we started writing, we were looking for, I suppose, first of all, revenue for Ellie, because having being a young woman who lived in London, mm-hmm. it's expensive, and especially if you're going to buy vintage Macintosh jackets.
£375.
I think it would probably be higher than that.
Oh my God. For a good, in that condition, yeah. $850 easy.
Bloody
hell. So there was that, and also another place for her to be at night, another place for the character to explore. And
yeah.
and so I pushed for her to have a job, and I thought, well, why shouldn't she have the job I had? Because it was great at the Toucan. And then you loved that idea.
Yeah, no, it made a lot of sense to have sort of another location to it. And when we first met, it was through like sort of Sam Mendes, like he and it wasn't necessarily saying that we should work together. It was literally just apropos of nothing. He said, do you know Christy Wilson Cairns? And I said, no. And he goes, oh, you guys should meet. You get in like a house on fire. And the first time that we met was in 2016. It was when I was editing Baby Driver.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sitting in, and this is like, forgive us, but it's pertinent to it. We were sitting in the Soho house on Dean Street. Some people are going, oh, of course, media wankers. But the reason I say that is because directly opposite Soho House, and this says everything about Soho itself if you don't know the place of where there's the kind of like the sort of like the height of show business and also the kind of the seedier side, is it's directly opposite one of the few strip clubs left in Soho.
Right.
Sunset Strip. And Christy pointed to Sunset Strip and said, I used to live above Sunset Strip for 5 years.
Yeah.
Whilst I was working at the Toucan round the corner. And I was like, you used to work at the Toucan? I probably met you before.
Yeah, I've almost definitely served you.
Yes.
Almost definitely served you.
So that was that thing where that it was like a no-brainer to bring that place into it, you know?
Okay, so that brings me on then to ask you some of the questions that I always wanted to ask you about this movie. And one of which is basically those early conversations. So you've had this idea for a while, Edgar, about, you know, doing something in Soho. And we've talked before about the time travel element and the fact that it spans the present day and, of course, the 60s as well. The idea that, you know, you should be careful what you wish for. Nostalgia is not all it used to be, all that sort of stuff. But what we haven't talked about is the central story, in a way, and the way that, you know, the twist with Miss Collins and Sandy and all that stuff, and Eight Gooch Place being a central part of the story. So at what point did that all start to click for you both? You know, essentially taking your idea and appending this murder mystery structure to it.
Well, I mean, that part of it was always there, actually. The plot was the plot. I think when I after this time, first time I met Christy, as soon as you mentioned about where I used to work, I said, I have this story I want to tell you. And then we went out on a separate night.
Yes. We went on a basically a dingy, gritty part of Soho pub crawl, led by me, of course. And we ended up in the basement bar Trisha's, which is, you know, a fair institution. Mm. And
has Trisha survived the pandemic?
I think I don't think anything could kill Trisha's. I'd be very surprised if it hadn't. But I've seen people going in and out. I haven't been back since. But in Trisha's, he told me the story that would become Last Night in Soho. And this wasn't as a collaborator. This was just, you know, as a friend on a fun night out. And I was like totally and utterly like got by it. I used to think about it every time I went through Soho after that, which was a lot. And then I think it was about 9 months after that you phoned me up and said, oh, do you want to write it with me? And that's like a really easy yes, because I'm a fan of it.
Let me think about that for a second.
Yeah. I think I was saying yes before you'd finished the question. I was just going, yes, yes, yes.
I was in Los Angeles and you said, but you, I think you were about to go off and work with Sam on 1917 and you said, I can do it, but can you do it like right now? In the next like 6 weeks or 8 weeks? So I flew back from Los Angeles to write it with Christy in London. To answer your question though, the plot was always the plot. I don't think the plot actually sort of changed. The things that did come into it, obviously, with, you know, kind of Christy's kind of suggestions were things that sort of changed the movie in significant ways. And like a big part of that is kind of like sort of deepening what was there in terms of the characters and how you bring, you know, shared personal experiences and very like unique personal experiences to it. And then also, like, I think of a couple of things that you suggested that kind of like massively changed it. One is the idea of like the Toucan was one of them, of her having another place to go and other people to talk to about it in a way that kind of like would bring other locations into it, which would sort of dovetail the characters in a really nice way. But also a big one was like, I had originally thought of the 60s sequences being silent. Like they would be like, you know, like musical sequences where
production numbers.
Sandy didn't like speak. And you made one of your big, and you know, I think the first time that we met, like to actually write it, I think you said, I think it's really important that we dramatize the Sandy scenes, because if we're going to obsess about her in the way that Eloise does, and also that the audience need to fall in love with Sandy for the whole thing to work, you've got to hear her speak. And it was like a big suggestion, which like I hadn't thought of, and obviously like, and also not just changes the movie like sort of in a really great way, but also I think then us writing all of those scenes, as soon as we started writing the Café de Paris scene, I was thinking, oh, I can't believe I didn't think of this myself, this is great. I mean, is there any, what are the other things? I'm trying to think that what, like, sort of, that wasn't there in the outline that then had a, I mean, obviously, like, is, like, character and history and all of those things.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, like, it's depth, isn't it? When you have an outline, it's, like, a story you can tell in what, I think you probably told it to me in 25, 30 minutes. So
it's like the campfire version of it.
So, like, everything's there, the twists and everything like that, but yeah, I think when you actually get into then, oh, how am I going to execute this for the big screen? You have to think about, well, what's all the backstory? And you had all that amazing research. And then you had the playlist as well. And I think those, the research, the story and the playlist, we were just merging them in a way that was quite holistic.
But also, I think also where you just bring all of our personal experience into it, things that have happened to us, things that have happened to our family, people that we know, like first-hand, second-hand, third-hand stories. You spend a lot of time talking about that as well. And those things that, I mean, some of those which we talk about on the commentary, where things that somebody has told you in passing that has never left you, or things that have been said to you directly working as a barmaid or as a young woman in London, or me talking to a cop during the research for Hot Fuzz that inspired a line that Terrence Stamp says that, like, when Simon Pegg saw the movie, the first thing he said to me goes, "Oh my God, I can't believe you used that slab line." Okay, so when we were researching Hot Fuzz, we did a lot of interviews with cops. And one night we went out with my girlfriend at the time, like a drummer that she sort of played with, his brother was a homicide detective in Camden. And we went out with like the homicide squad in a pub just near Holborn. I think it's called the Three Little Pigs, or it's something to do with pigs. And we did go there with cops, but that was their choice, not ours. I think it's called the Three Little Pigs. It's near the old Central St. Martin's building. Anyway, and it was a great, and the guy that I knew is great, and I've stayed in contact with him since, you know. And but it was getting a bit like dark. Like the conversation, like as the white wine flowed, I remember the conversation getting darker and darker. And I could see Simon getting a bit kind of on edge. And one of the guys had, at the start of the conversation, had said, "Oh, before you go, I've got to get you to sign an autograph for my nephew." And Simon says, "Sure, sure." And then there was, the conversation was starting to get dark to the point where Simon was like, I'm gonna get a cab, actually, I'm gonna go. And so he left before me. And this guy goes, "Oh, I gotta get that autograph." And as he got out, I can't remember what he was getting autographed. Maybe it was a Shaun of the Dead DVD or something.
Maybe it was a confession.
Just he said, and forgive the swearing here, but this is what he actually said, because it's never left me. He sort of said, he went to sort of take the Sharpie and the DVD and send it to Simon. And then he had that feeling of like feeling embarrassed to do so. Mm-hmm. And he goes, "Oh, I feel like a right cunt asking you now." He goes, "Because we're both the same, aren't we? I mean, we all look the same on a slab." And like, at that point, Simon like couldn't have signed the DVD faster and was like out of there. And it was that thing, and me and Simon used to talk about it all the time. It's like, "We all look the same on a slab." So it was when Terrence Stamp is talking in his big scene in The Toucan. And let's say this is a spoiler special. Terrence Stamp is not the killer. He is not Jack. Mm-hmm. But he is, as a lot of Soho Vice people were back in the 60s, a bad man. I mean, in fact, my favourite line of the script, or my favourite line of Terrence's, is when she says, "I know what you did." And he goes, "I done a lot of things. You have to be more specific, love." And it's like, yeah, these guys were like bad guys. And like the Soho Vice cops of the time were sort of like so thick as thieves with the pornographers and the gangsters and just kind of all creaming off the top. And like, you know, infamously, Soho Vice cops at the time would be, rather than busting prostitutes, would go in and, you know, have sex for free, you know, and just kind of, and steal their money as well.
Yeah.
And like, what are you going to do about it? You
Precisely.
Know, like sort of some bad, bad people working at that time. So we always thought that, you know, like Terrence's character is one of those guys. And so the idea of like how, what he kind of thinks of kind of like sort of just life itself and of Sandy, as he goes, "We all look the same on..." She thought she was better than this, but you know, at the end of the day, we all look the same on a slab. It's just like, oh, what a horrible thing to say.
Shivers.
Yeah. But that's the thing, is like, that's something that somebody had said to me and Simon in 2006. Mm. I sort of been sitting on this thing, and I mean, I don't know how you feel about this, but it's the thing where like things that are buried in your mind, in your memory of things that have been said, don't come up until there's a situation which kind of like demands it. I mean, you know.
No, it's like you're just hanging on to them back there in the cupboard that you can't quite access in your head all the time. And then I just, like, sometimes you'll be writing something, you'll be like, "Oh, yeah.
I remember when."
Oh, yeah. Mm. That thing my mum said to me in 2009.
No, well, you have,
like, now you're going to see it.
There's another line, there's quite a few lines. I mean, you have a bunch of them as well, but there's a line in that happens to Eloise.
Oh,
and it's
yeah.
that thing where, like, you know, it's funny because if you say, "Oh, you know, Eloise is quite personal to me in a way," it's like, well, what do you have in common with an 18-year-old girl from Cornwall? It's like, well, strangely, like, between me and my mother and my sister-in-law, you know, who is from Cornwall and, like, did fashion design at art college and came to London. My mum, who like sort of also studied sort of dressmaking at art college, and your yeah. kind of like mum and grandmother and my grandmother and great grandmother all like have a history of like being in dressmaking or being seamstresses or being jewelry makers. And but the story that revolves around Eloise is separate to that, is when she's in the kind of the halls of residence kitchen party, a location that I could not wait to get out of. Very sweaty and awful, like a lot of those parties. And she's listening to the Kinks on her Beats headphones. And then a character who I think in the script is called Drunk Arsehole.
Yeah, yeah.
comes up, takes the headphones off her, listens to the Kinks and goes, you know, like sort of like, what the fuck are you listening? Why are you listening to this fucking granny music? How old are you? Now, when I was like 16, I was around a house party. The house party of a girl that I really had a crush on. Let's call her Joanne. That's her real name. I won't say her surname. And at her party, I was like put on a C90 compilation of like things that I liked, which involved a lot of 60s songs. And you know, this is 1990 when most people are listening to Jesus Jones or something like that. And I put it on, and my friend Gavin, I will say his full name, Gavin Elwood, you know who you are. Anyway, I love you, Gavin. But he heard the Kinks, and I think it was the song Victoria, and he just said, you know, without knowing, he said, who put this old music on? which has stayed with me forever, because it was not only that he didn't like what I put on, but he vocally didn't like it in front of a girl that I fancied, and it was I'd put it on, and so my music was switched off.
That's amazing.
And it's never left me, the shame and embarrassment of my music taste being called out.
Quick aside on that, did you because obviously Terrence Stamp is name checked in a King song, isn't it, in Waterloo Sunset? Did that cross your mind at any point?
Well, I mean, and also Julie Christie is on a poster in the movie. Well, bizarrely enough, I had to speak to Julie Christie in relation to this film, because I had been in contact with her before, bizarrely enough. And then way later, I had actually spoken to Julie Christie on the phone, and which was an amazing experience once. And then way, way, way later, nearly before finishing the film, there's like sometimes clearance things come up, and we were using the Darling poster outside the cinema, the quad of John Schlesinger's Darling, which amazingly I actually own the exact same poster. And the clearance person said, oh, actually, we need to get Julie Christie's sign off on her image. And I was like, I could call Julie Christie. I think I emailed her agent first and said, is it okay if I call Julie about something? And I called her and asked her permission for the Darling poster, so I did have to speak to her. And she did say, she goes, oh, I'm looking forward to seeing your film. All of my friends are in it, Terry and Rita, which is just like an amazing thing to kind of hear.
Oh my God.
So I assume that they're all good by the fact that she said my friend Terry, but also what an amazing thing to be immortalized in that song.
Yeah.
I remember though, because there's a Kink song in the movie. Actually, no, Waterloo Sunset is in the movie. Like when she first comes to London and she's driving and she goes through Piccadilly Circus, you hear a busker playing Piccadilly. Okay. Because I thought like, okay, if you got a busker in Piccadilly Circus, what's the most London song they could be playing? And me and Steve Price went onto YouTube, this is true, found a busker playing Waterloo Sunset, used that recording, and then got in touch with the busker themselves. And so they're credited at the end of the movie. It says performed by, it's actually a busker playing Waterloo Sunset. But I did think, I wasn't sure how Terrence Stamp, and I never was too nervous to ask him how he felt about it. I've said, I wish I'd asked him actually, how do you feel about Waterloo Sunset? I'm sure he must love it. It's immortalized in a classic London song.
I seem to recall he was one of the first people who ever did a special interview with us in the podcast back in 2012. And on the way down in the lift, we asked him about Waterloo Sunset.
And what did he say?
He said, I'm a big fan of the song. He's, but it's taken a while to love it. But yeah.
Well, I noticed actually on the set, like, I don't know why I was like, so I think it was when we were shooting at Paddington Station, our second AD, Tom, started whistling Waterloo Sunset. Or maybe it was our first AD. In fact, it was probably one of those things where an earworm goes around. Mm. Once one person starts whistling it, I think it's both Richard Gray's Mark and Tom, our first and second AD, were whistling Waterloo Sunset. And I said, don't whistle that in front of Terrence. Because I wasn't sure whether he was okay with it or not. Also, why are you whistling Waterloo Sunset at Paddington Station? You're in the wrong station. Come on. So I'd say, wrong station, guys. Wrong station. This is Paddington. Do the Paddington theme tune.
So, drunk arsehole is now in the credits, you know, as drunk student.
You know, we're just kind of vamping, oh, yeah, so we don't have to answer any spoiler questions at this point.
This is fine. This is fine. We're taking the long route. We're taking the geographically unsound route towards spoilers. Yeah. So drunk arsehole is now drunk student in the credits.
Connor, so the other guy's drunk arsehole. There's the other guy as well. There's two drunk. What's the guy?
I'm not seeing a drunk arsehole in the credits. Here.
I think names because we had a lot of swear names.
Oh, I know what it was. Oh, this is true. What's the other guy called? Connor, the one who's in the toucan. What's his character name?
Oh, that must be who I'm talking about then, because that is drunk student. Okay. Oh, yes, that's the guy.
There's two. What's the one? Josh. Josh Zari is the other one. What's his character name?
It's not coming up. It is not coming up.
I forget. I tell you what, though. All right. This is true. It was in the script as drunk arsehole. Yeah. And out of like, in respect to Connor and Josh, who played those two characters, I said, you don't want to have drunk arsehole on your IMDb. Let's change it to drunk student.
So that student at party. Student at party.
Student at party.
There you go.
Because it was, I think it was like drunk arsehole and like arsehole at party or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, okay, so at the party, when he takes her headphones off, I don't know if that's ever happened to you. I think it might be something that men strictly do to women.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I've been on the street and a man has just removed my headphones so that he can speak to me, which is such an invasion of personal space. So I think calling him drunk arsehole was totally fair.
Oh,
and
that's
he played
mild.
That part beautifully.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a darker stuff to talk about, but let's talk about the cab driver scene.
Oh, my God. I mean, when we were writing the cab driver scene, you know, a lot of the time we wanted to have it so that it wasn't just out and out pure rapey. Mm-hmm. And so you're sort of drawn on your own experiences. And I was like, every time I'd been in a cab and they'd send something, that they were like, if you had said, you know what, this makes me uncomfortable, they'd be like, it's a compliment, love. It's a compliment. Don't be a prissy bitch. It's a compliment.
Oh,
and I've definitely had like everything.
Smile, love.
I'll give us a smile.
Yeah.
It might never happen, that. And there was a lot of just horrible cab drivers. And then, of course, the drunk guy at the bar.
There are, we should say, there are nice cab drivers as well.
Oh, there are.
Nice cab drivers are available.
Nice cab drivers. You've got to request them separately.
But there's a thing as well about, you know, especially with other ride services these days as well, about, you know, how much do I want this person to know exactly where I live?
Yes.
Well, yeah.
I must say, every time...
12 Gooch Place.
Every time I'm in a cab... and they've ever dropped a celebrity off, they tell me exactly where they dropped that celebrity off.
Christ,
which is
really?
Such a weird thing to do. And then hilarious, I was in a cab the other day and they were talking about a producer who I won't name, who they drive to the airport all the time.
I'll go on, name him.
And I won't name him. And he apparently was saying how annoying it is because women can't write action. And he was going on and on and on. And he was like, what do you do? And I was like, I write action. I'm a female screenwriter. And then I got out. Right.
Have you seen
the
little film called...
This producer said that?
No, this producer said it to the taxi driver.
Oh.
He's like, you got to hire women to play women. You got to hire women to write action. And I was like, oh, that's fun. And he was like, what do you do, love? And I was
You're
like,
doing
well,
a very voice there.
I know. I don't know if
don't
you can
put that
tell.
In. Can you bleep that out?
I'll bleep that out.
I'll bleep it.
I'll bleep everything but
I don't know if you can tell, I can't do any other accent but this one.
Right.
This is the only accent I can do. If I could do another one, I think I would definitely mix it up.
I had a similar thing actually in the last time I took a black
cab. If you hear the bleeped name and on Twitter you rewrite it, I'll like that tweet if it's correct.
I had a cabbie a few weeks ago. And we got talking about football because I was going to the train station to go to Liverpool to see a football match. And he went, oh, I watched that England women's last night. Yeah, it was good. They won 10-0. It was pretty good. Pretty good game. But yeah, women, thing about women is they don't have the physical capability to kick the ball. That's why the score's so high. They can't kick the ball more than 10 yards. It's like, I don't think that's true.
So some of the women can kick the ball, but some of the women can't. Is that with it?
That's where he was going. I was like, oh, mate, please, you've been so good. You've been so good up to now.
Every so often you're fine, and then they'll just come up with something. And they'll be like, Brexit. And you're like, no.
I'm going to get out of here.
You know what? I'll walk.
Yeah,
but,
I'm fine.
Have you ever lied to a cab driver because you want them to stop talking?
Yes.
I think once I was in such a, I think I did this once. It's a terrible thing to do. That sort of some guy was talking so much that I eventually lied and said, I'm so sorry, I don't want to talk right now, I've had a death in the family. And he goes, oh, I'm so sorry. I don't know why I thought that that would shut him up, but it did.
Holy shit.
That's actually a great tip for all women out there. In an awkward situation with a cab driver, just say you've had a death in the family.
I'm sorry, I can't talk right now, I've had a death in the family. Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Silence.
I'm sorry, I don't want to be objectified right now. I've just had a death in the family.
I was thinking that, you know that thing they say on cabs where it says you have a right to... have a radio-free journey?
Yeah.
I always think that specifically means you have a right not to listen to Nick Ferrari in the car. Because if you're stuck in traffic and have to listen to that, it's like, woof.
Yeah. Even if a show isn't on, somehow they're playing it. I don't know how that works.
They're like, this is my compilation of my favourite bits.
You don't have to bleep Nick Ferrari.
The other the other true-to-life quote was, I remember we were writing the stuff in the toucan.
Yes.
And we were talking about, and Edgar goes, what's the worst pickup line you've ever heard? And I was like, oh, hang on. I was like, let's rank them. And then, obviously,
this
number
is the line
one,
that Connor says.
Yeah, number one with a eel is the, my dick just died, can I bury it in your arse? And I remember saying it to you, and you just went, oh, no. Like, on behalf of all men everywhere, you were like, oh, no, I'm sorry about that.
Oh my God. Was I far ahead of number two and number three? And
not really.
I don't really.
Not
okay.
Really. I wouldn't go through the list.
No, let's not do that.
And
no.
Also, you'd have to bleep so much of it.
Oh no, we bleep very, very little on this podcast. It's totally fine. It's like Roy W. Brown concert in here half the time. But speaking of.
The mayor of Royston Vasey.
speaking of character names, Sam Claflin
Yes. Is
punter number five.
Yes.
And Diana Rigg is Miss Collins. And obviously you don't want to give away things. So can you talk about that very specific approach to seeding those characters who have counterparts in the 60s and counterparts in the present day as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes you're thinking, I wrestled with the idea of putting Sam Claflin in there at all. But if you don't, then on IMDb, if you don't put punter number five, somebody will put in young Lindsay and then ruin it. Like, so I kind of thought, well, either we have him uncredited or we just call him punter number five. And actually, when I spoke to Sam Claflin, I called him like to offer him the part, because obviously it's a very small part. And I think I called him to talk to him about it before going to his agent. And I said, hey, I have this role in my movie and it's probably going to be uncredited, or even if it is, you're going to be punter number five, but you're playing the young Terrence Stamp. And Sam said, he goes, that's funny, because the first day I was at sort of drama school or drama college, my tutor said, you look like a young Terrence Stamp. And I'm ashamed to say at the time, I didn't know who he was. And then I looked him up and I said, oh, that's nice. You know? And then funny enough, Terrence, we've got lots of Terrence stories all of a sudden, but Terrence, like, I'm not sure Terrence is kind of maybe knows too many kind of younger actors out there, but I said to him, oh, I found the actor that's going to play the young you. And I held up this black and white headshot of Sam Claflin looking particularly handsome and sultry. And Terrence looked at the headshot and goes, oh, yeah, very good. I think so, but Sam does look like Terrence Stamp.
Oh, yeah.
He sounds like him too. It's really good.
Well, I mean, what's interesting is both Matt Smith and Sam, I gave them both the same Terrence Stamp film to watch and say, watch this and kind of ape Terrence, which was Ken Loach's Poor Cow.
Mm-hmm.
Because that, I think, there's many great 60s Terrence Stamp films, but in Poor Cow, he's at his most naturalistic and, you know, because it's a Ken Loach film, he's at his, you know, kind of like, feels the most real, where he's like the Terrence that grew up in kind of like the Terrence from Bow, you know, in East London. I think he's in Bow or Stepney. So, Let me look it up. Google it.
I'll Google it.
Just Google it now and see if I'm right and if it's Bow.
Terrence Stamp. Bow. Yeah, Bow.
It is Bow.
Born and lived in Canal Road, Bow, until German bombers forced his family to move to Plaistow.
There you go.
There you go. That's a cracking start to your IMDb profile.
Yeah. German bombers just coming for Terrence Stamp.
Christy, of
they
course, wrote her
IMDb
profile.
Couldn't take out Zod.
Yeah, precisely.
Hitler couldn't take out Zod.
Kneel before Zod. Superman. Yeah. I love that film. Anyway, yes. So, in terms of that, in terms of crafting that red herring, I thought it was very, very interesting. In fact, there's a number of red herrings all the way through the movie where you're. How much were you expecting audiences to be trying to put two and two together with, say, for example, Diana Rigg and Anya Taylor-Joy? And did you almost want what happens later on when Eloise has the vision of what she thinks is Sandy being murdered? Were you deliberately misdirecting people at that point?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think in the classic tradition of those films, I think with films with twists in, one of the joys of them is if the twist works, it makes you want to watch it immediately again. Mm. Like, I remember when I saw something like The Sixth Sense, you think, I want to see that film again, knowing the ending. And, or something like one of the great giallos, the greatest giallo, in my opinion, Dario Argento's Deep Red. Mm. It has like a twist in it towards the end, where as soon as I think I first watched it on VHS, and the first thing I did was rewind it to the earlier scene to check that it wasn't cheating, and it wasn't. And you're thinking, holy shit, like the fucking twist is there in plain sight in the first 20 minutes, but you don't know what the twist is until you see the ending of the film. Mm-hmm. And I think, I'm not going to spoil Deep Red for anybody who's never seen it. So if you haven't seen Deep Red, watch it, aka Profondo Rosso, an absolute classic. So to answer your question, so that murder scene in inverted commas, if you actually watch it again, you don't see kind of like the knife going into Anya. Mm-hmm. You don't see, so actually what we designed is like the setup for it. And even the idea of like, you know, and whether this is cheating or not, but like you see the kind of the throes of sort of agony and you see Anya getting splashed with blood. But then when you see what really happens at the end is that actually like Sandy kills Jack. Mm. She sort of is stabbing Jack and getting splattered with his blood. So kind of what you're seeing in the earlier scene, what Eloise sees, is like she sees the kind of like the sort of the result of something without seeing the full kind of like context of it. And partly because at the moment that it's happening, the door has opened and Miss Collins herself is standing at the door and flooding the bedroom with like yellow light from the hallway. Mm. So it's almost like the vision is disrupted by the older version of Sandy herself. That was always the kind of premise of that bit. And so we were going to work very hard when we were shooting those scenes. He's like, you see a shot of Matt Smith kind of like grimacing. And it looks like he's grimacing because he's killing her, but he's not. He's grimacing because he's being stabbed. You see a shot of Anya splattered with blood, but it's like Jack's blood, not hers. And then even the thing of like the shot where she turns kind of and like looks at Eloise and is like seemingly dying. Like in the other context, it's like she's exhausted after killing Jack, you know, and then sort of like, so we sort of like, I think that's the great thing with those things with like twists like that is that you're kind of like, you're trying to not cheat and you're trying to kind of give people a version of events which makes sense in two different contexts. The other great one like that, again, I won't spoil it, but like another Dario Argento film, The Bird with the Crystal Plumage, his debut, has a brilliant twist at the end where you see something, but what you're seeing is not quite what you think it is. Mm-hmm. And it's great. It's just like a brilliant, like, I'm a real, like, love any, like, twist like that that really sort of works and where you actually go back and watch it again to sort of make sure that the kind of the makers aren't cheating. And I realized maybe in Last Night Soho we come close to doing that, but that was sort of the whole idea. Is like, what if she's about to have a vision of a murder and at the point where the murder is actually kind of happening, it is disrupted by
the murderer.
The murderer herself coming into the room and flooding the place with light. So that was always the idea, yeah.
There's almost a suggestion in the film, certainly towards the end, but even in that scene, which I don't think is the case, but there is, I think it could be read this way, that when Diana Rigg, when Miss Collins opens the door, that she almost for a second sees the visions herself.
In the finale, yes. Yeah. I think she does, or she at least has the... Well, that's the thing is that actually... Well, she... And it's kind of intercut in a way. Yes, I think you're right. But what she's seeing is the memory of who those guys were.
Yeah.
Not what they are now. So when... I always like the idea that, like... And also that, you know, that... Yes, I think that's exactly right. Maybe she's not seeing it in exactly the same way Eloise is, but she has the memory of it. And, you know, that's when Jack appears as well. I mean, it's also something that kind of like, and maybe this is, people don't catch this and stuff or not, but she doesn't walk into the room until the end scene. In the early scenes, when she shows Eloise around the room, she stays outside the door. Mm. Even when she comes in to kind of like tell her off for like having a male visitor when Michael Ajayi's in the room, she doesn't come in, she stays outside. Mm. But then in the final scene, she comes into the room. And so it's almost that thing of when she crosses the threshold into that room is where all the sense memory of what happened here comes back.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was definitely the intention.
Because that was the killing room. That was where. Yeah. Did you sketch out roughly how many guys she killed? How long that spree went on for? Did it go into the 70s and beyond?
Well, I think there's like sort of in the scene you see there's like 12 of them or something.
Mm.
I was funny. We did like 2 test screenings for the film. And in both, like, you get the cards and stuff. And in both screenings, like, 2 different cards, both by men, said, "I find it very hard to believe that a woman would be able to kill 12 guys and dispose of the bodies." And I was like, "You're so fucking sexist. How dare you? How dare you say that a woman can't do the same as what a man can do?
Women can do anything. Women can be serial killers too."
Yes.
True equality.
We know that.
The way you looked at me there was really terrifying.
I'm like,
How dare you suggest that a woman couldn't do that?
I have a theory that women would be better at getting away with murder.
Yeah, they would be better at disposing of them. Oh, yeah.
More.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I know exactly what to remove blood. I know how to clean shit up, okay?
Oh, wow.
Spent a lot of time.
Okay. Let's just say on record.
Not murdering. Well,
no, of course not.
Some cats,
no.
Christy
you know.
Wilson Cairns would be a more successful serial killer than me.
Yeah. Our podcast.
That's just because I like empathy.
Our podcast admissible as confessions.
I hope not. I mean, my lawyer's going to have a word with you after this. Please don't ever play this in a court of law.
No, of course not. Of course not.
We sort of had this idea of the timeline and also this idea of like that she kind of eventually inherits the building.
Yeah.
We like this idea that maybe when she says at the start of the film that she bought it for buttons off the old owner, that there might be something else that happened there.
Yes.
I mean, I was always sort of inspired by not just kind of stories of real life serial killers. Obviously, somebody like John Christie, who's immortalized in more than one version of Ten Rillington Place, was somebody that came to mind. But it was also sort of other stories about people who had stayed in the industry. And it was something that I kind of like heard these stories and it would start to sort of make you think about the buildings themselves and the people that live in Soho who are that age. And it's that thing, I think I talk about it on the commentary, where my hairdresser, like sort of his salon, which is still there, used to be next door to a brothel, which is not there anymore. In fact, the same one that you saw knocked down.
Yeah.
He had been talking to the lady who lived opposite for like many years, who was like a maid, which is like a maid is like essentially a secretary to like a prostitute or somebody that is there for sort of security or taking the money and stuff, usually an older lady.
Is that different from a madam? What's a madam?
A madam is, I guess, the person who organises it.
Yeah, so okay. The madam's getting rich.
Yes, like Cynthia Payne. Cynthia Payne was a famous madam, yeah.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Or like Heidi Fleiss in the States. And what was Heidi Fleiss's boss's name? Madam Alex.
Oh, yeah.
There was also this story as well. I remember we were trying to think of the name of this person, but I remember there was a story in the mid-90s that was a big deal in like the Evening Standard of like a madam in Marylebone, I think, who had been sort of taken to prison, and she had owned so much property in that area that she was like sort of, was essentially like a landlady and like a madam at the same time. But a maid is somebody who works for the sort of prostitute and is then collecting the money, I guess, to give to the gangsters, etc. But anyway, but my hairdresser had been talking to this lady for years. And then one day she was talking and she said that she had used to work in the place as a prostitute. And that the young woman that was working there now was her daughter. And something like that story just gave me such kind of chills.
Yeah.
And in fact, there was a lot of stuff in the research that was along the same lines of like that this was sometimes that people like sort of, you know, like daughters, mothers, grandmothers who had all worked in the same trade. And so there's just sort of this sense of like Miss Collins had kind of like, you know, gone from being like sort of somebody who worked in that place to being like sort of like the madam stroke maid to then eventually leaving the business and just being the landlady of the place, but along the way inheriting the building and perhaps in a darker way, you know.
Yeah, perhaps the landlord did not retire.
Mm. Yes.
He was in the mix.
Well, perhaps he retired permanently.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. But to answer your question, the other thing as well that's fun about writing some of this is like leaving breadcrumbs, like for people to say, hopefully, I think if you watch the movie a second time, like pretty much everything that both Diana Rigg and even Rita Tushingham say is kind of quite, and Terrence as well, they're all quite loaded statements. And I remember when we had one of the test screenings in the focus group. And again, it was amazing because you have this focus group where you have about 20 people. And there were like these two dudes were sitting right on the far reaches that didn't look like the kind of guys who would enjoy a movie like this, but like were sort of really into it. And then another guy in the focus group said, if there were like 12 bodies in the bedroom, wouldn't it smell? And then one of these dudes said, she said about the garlic in the first scene. The place smells of garlic. And then everybody else in the focus group went, oh. And I felt very happy about that.
It's fun watching them. It's so hard writing them. I remember going through the script. Remember we would spend like, I think we spent at least a week just checking the red herrings, checking, yeah. And I'm talking just in the first draft. Just like going through stuff. And then there was so much of the red herrings and those breadcrumbs where like you would try and give it to someone that hadn't read it yet. So like my mum, like friends, agents, all this. It'd be like, can you guess the ending? Is there enough red herring where it doesn't feel like it comes out the blue? Are there enough little breadcrumbs? So it's really fun to watch. I love watching it now, but I remember at the time just being like, oh my God, how are we going to get away with this? How are we going to justify this?
Yeah.
Well, there's a funny thing that Diana Rigg does in it, which is great, is that when anything kind of revolves around like her past or even like who Sandy was or what she'd become, she responds to it in that slightly irritated, like non-answers, in the same way that Diana Rigg sometimes, when she's not in the mood, would kind of like, if somebody asked her about the Avengers, would have these kind of brush-off answers. And I noticed this because like we talked to her at length, but when she was in a good mood, with people that she wanted to talk to rather, she would be happily tell all the stories. But if she was kind of like not wanting to kind of go back, she'd have this, her like sort of non-answer would be if somebody asked her about the Avengers, she goes, or the 60s, she goes, I don't remember the 60s, darling, I was shooting the Avengers. And she of course she remembers it, but she doesn't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
And so in a way, like what I like about the way that Diana Rigg plays Miss Collins is that like any like talk of like Sandy or who she was all the time, or even like the sense of what happened, is like to just be kind of like dismissed in a slightly kind of irritated manner.
Yeah.
It's like the way that she responds to like Eloise asking her directly about somebody called Sandy. She says, like, not that again. Like, it's like, I just love the way that she does it, where she's kind of just sort of doesn't want to be engaged at all. And like, it's just like, it's just kind of like, just in a very kind of cold way, has like, I've moved on. You know?
I love the layer of that as well, that kind of like that, it, like frustrated like breath that she does when Ellie says, you know, it was her girl called Sandy that lived in that room. Because I always think like Mrs. Collins, when she was then, you know, out in the world afterwards, she would never want anyone to know her past. Partly because obviously she's a serial killer, but also I think she was deeply ashamed of it. And I think like Diana Rigg manages to encompass all of that, like all of that backstory and not even a line of dialogue. It's unbelievable watching her do it.
Well, it's also, for us as well, you have to find, I mean, we do have empathy with Sandy. Mm. Kind of what the point of the movie is that Eloise, through her special gift of being able to kind of like relive somebody else's memories, she has real empathy for what Sandy went through because she was there. Sometimes that she was like in her body experiencing it. So even though we don't like, we're not necessarily condoning the crimes, and neither is Eloise, but she understands how she came to be in that place. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the movie, it's like Eloise is trying to save young Sandy, which she can't do. That's impossible. And Miss Collins doesn't want to be saved by Eloise. Mm-hmm. She sort of wants to kind of go out on her own terms and not be saved, you know, like, and so that was always like the, you know, I remember like one time there was one note from the studio. They said, can't Eloise just save Miss Collins from the fire? And I was like,
no.
And what, go to prison?
Yeah.
Like, sort of like, what ending is that? Like, that's just like, you know.
Yeah.
That's no, I mean, for me, what I like about the ending, even if it's kind of like, sort of like, has a sort of like, leaves a sour taste, is that Miss Collins wants to go out on her own terms, you know, and doesn't want to be saved by this girl. But what I was going to get to is like, in that sense of empathy, I think a lot of the times you have to find what the kind of the character is going through. And I always like the idea that like It's not like I necessarily agree with it, but I understand it from Miss Collins' point of view of why she does what she does to Eloise and John. Because if you think, if you had got away with this crime for like 50 years, and then all of a sudden, this like Nancy Drew with like kind of like this 18-year-old Nancy Drew, who you know to be very naive, regardless of her supernatural powers, is going to come along and sort of blow everything and has talked to a police officer about it and essentially told a police officer about what may or may not have happened in that room, that like, if you were that person of like, sort of like, wait, this is happening like 55, what would it be, 50, 65? Like, so it's like sort of,
50 plus
years later.
Yeah.
That she's in that kind of like, sort of, I wouldn't say that she doesn't seem like a character that's panicked, but she's like, I have to do something about this. And like, sort of, you know, so I and what's interesting for us as well is having written that character is that Diana Rigg lent so hard into the darkness of it in a way that what I love about Diana Rigg and what she said to me the first time I met her after reading the script and agreeing to do the part, she said, some people are put off by dark material, but I'm not. With that in mind, what I love about Diana Rigg and the way that she plays Miss Collins is that Diana Rigg doesn't need to be liked.
Yeah.
There are some actors who on screen who kind of, even in like darker parts, are wrestling with being like likable on screen.
Mm-hmm.
There's one that I won't mention in the movie, but there's one film I saw recently where there's a sort of a problem in the movie where a character who is like a bad person, the actor is so sort of like, feels so needy to be liked all the time that it creates a real like odd dynamic. I'll tell you afterwards. But, anyway, but with Diana Rigg, she doesn't have that. And what I love about it is that it's quite shocking, like when she starts talking and how kind of like unrepentant she is in a way, like that about what she's doing and even what she did. And I think Diana leans into that so hard that I remember when we first heard her do it in rehearsal, we just got excited because it was exactly the words that we'd written, but it was so kind of like bracing and like sour and nasty and even funny at the same time.
That was the thing, is like, I think watching Diana do it, it wasn't you were watching Diana do this like page of dialogue. It was that you were watching Mrs. Collins be alive for the first time, and all of a sudden, and in a rehearsal room, and like, I think we were at a church in Ealing. It was like, it was like amazing to see that come true.
My favorite part of that scene is when she breaks out of talking about killing all of these punters and says, oh, and Ellie, I can call you Ellie, can't I? And Thomasine goes, yes. Like, that's my favourite bit, is where they sort of break out of it just to check. It's okay to call you Ellie, right? And then she just, I mean, also, it must be said, Diana Rigg as a sort of, sorry, I interrupt in a sort of very mansplaining way. She is a Broadway and West End veteran. Mm. She just, like, learned all of that dialogue and just had it down and would just kind of, like, rattle through take after take, word perfect. It was astonishing to watch.
Yeah, it was really incredible. But yeah, that was the other thing I was going to say about Mrs. Collins is like, when it comes to murdering, you know, John and Ellie, murder's been very successful for her in the past as a problem solving device. She's used it. And so, like, I always thought, oh, of course, yeah, that was the first thing she would leap to. She's like, yeah, I'll kill her. I'll make this one look like a suicide because the cops have come round worried that this girl's going to do it anyway. So she's like, oh, I can get away with that. And then when John appears, she's like, all right, I guess I'm going to have to make another space in the floorboards.
It's like riding a bike.
Yeah.
You never forget.
She never forgets.
But then when she comes into that scene at the end, as you say, when you feel that she's seen the vision herself, or at least has the sense memory of the situation, the knife drops.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then, like, she goes back to, she's suddenly sort of becoming kind of like sort of the person she was before, in terms of when she looks at herself in the mirror and says, I never wanted any of this.
Mm.
You know, and Eloise says, I know, I saw. So that's the point where, you know, just kind of pre sort of like, you know, she's going to kill herself, which Eloise stops her from doing. And that was always like, to me, that's the thing that that's what really I find very emotional about it is that like, Eloise still wants to save her. Of course she would. It's like you, and also she doesn't want to. When the dead punters are asking, like Eloise to kill Mrs. Collins, her answer is no.
Yeah.
Because that's not the answer either.
See, that was a big moment as well, because you have this really complex thing. I think you even quote Nancy Meyers on the commentary, say it's complicated when it comes to Miss Collins. Yeah. And
I've forgotten that I'd mentioned Nancy Meyers.
I mean, something's got to give, right?
If I really wanted to pay homage to Nancy Meyers, I would have the most ridiculous kitchen you've ever seen.
Instead, you just have a kitchenette.
A kitchen.
And there you go. That was a lengthy excerpt from our Last Night in Soho spoiler special interview with Edgar Wright and Christy Wilson-Cairns. If you liked that, and if you didn't, you must be some kind of faceless grey man. There's plenty more where that came from, folks. About 90 minutes more, in fact, for spoiler special subscribers. Do check out my pinned tweet for details of how to sign up. I'm at Chris Hewitt on Twitter, or simply go to empire.supportingcast.fm. to do so directly. And there's loads more coming your way if you subscribe, including a Scream spoiler special, another Spider-Man No Way Home pod, and weekly The Book of Boba Fett episodes, and tons, tons more. Plus, there are some goodies coming your way on the regular feed, also in addition to the regular podcast, and of course, our epic 500th episode bonanza. Anyway, that's enough of me. Until we meet again, thank you for listening. See you next time. Bye.